position number 11223, reel 2.
Mr. Howard, reel 2.
Yes, it was our own skins we were interested in at that time, survival. When in fact, at that time, we were listening to the battle which was taking place actually on Pegasus Bridge. And in fact, a German tank had been hit, and we could in fact see the glow of this tank on fire, presumably, or the ammunition on fire. Four or 500 yards away from us. And then it suddenly dawned upon you that there might be bullets flying in your particular direction at that time. And so it was a question of heads down. And I don't quite remember, but I found myself on the land side or the west bank of the bridge with my brain gunner, and it might have been before then or it might have been after them when in fact Johnny Merton and his section in fact shot up this German patrol and the British paratrooper got killed. Anyway, I found myself on the west side of the bridge in a little field, I suppose, a very small one, with a brain gunner. And at that time, the paras of the 6th Airborne Division, who had in fact landed between the River Dease and the Benneville complex, were in fact starting to come across our bridge. And we were in fact giving them encouragement and sort of pointing the way across to the along the road to Pegasus Bridge. And they were coming in singly. I think all of them came in singly. I can't think of any groups coming across at all. I think the drop had been reasonably successful, but Sticks of Powers had in fact become separated on their way down through the trees and into those low-lying fields of Normandy. And I suppose this went on for some little time.
How did you avoid shooting at each other by mistake?
Red berries. I'm pretty certain now that everybody had on a red berry. Yes, and as I say, I'm pretty certain all these powers came through with their red berries. In fact, on our side of the bridge at that time, there was very little activity, really. We felt then that we had troops, or British troops, to the east of us, which was in fact protecting that particular flank. So we felt more confident. In other words, we had British paratroops there. This went on probably all night. And by the time the sun came up in the morning, maybe 6 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, whatever the time was, and the light sort of dawned 4 miles away on the invasion beaches, we could in fact see the smoke arising out of the invasion, which was coming in by sea, which was encouraging at the time. I don't think we had any breakfast that morning. We had our iron rations, and the iron rations happened to be a tin which you put in your back pocket with a very thick block, very hard chocolate. But we had our cigarettes. We had our watertight cigarettes. They were supplied to us in a tin, which was watertight. 20 players to every man. And in those days, to find a man in the army who didn't smoke was a very rare event indeed. Especially as people in this country, I suppose 80%, 85% of people in the UK used to smoke. So we smoked. I don't think we had a brew up even. I don't think we had a cup of tea. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm... I don't know. But I don't think we had the facilities to make tea in any case. And anyway, we stayed in that particular position, I suppose, for 2 or 3 hours in the early morning sunlight. And by this time, my section had advanced into an orchard on the south side to, in fact... stop anybody coming up in between the river and the canal. A bit of sniper activity was taking place then, German sniper activity. There were one or two high buildings within a mile, I suppose, maybe half a mile. And certainly sniper's bullets were coming from those particular locations. And I was surprised we didn't get any mortar fire at all. The Germans did just not seem to be prepared and did not seem to accept that there were, in fact, troops in the vicinity. This was probably midday on D-Day. And I think my first link up with Pegasus Bridge. They were running short of ammunition on the other side, and so we piled all the ammunition we had, which were mortar bombs and rounds of 303. Onto an old farm cart we found, a horse-drawn farm cart, of course no horse there. And so two of my lads took hold of the front of the cart and tried to pull it along the road. And I went along with them, and it was a very difficult cart. In fact, it was one of those carts where if somebody pulled on it too heavily on the left, the whole shooting match skewed round, or vice versa. So the two people pulling it had to be very precise in how they pulled the damn thing. And we were very surprised, actually. I was surprised afterwards, not at the particular time, but we managed to take this cart with this ammunition on the 400 or 500 yards from the River Orme Bridge to the Pegasus Bridge, without any sniper activity at all. Nobody fired at us, which was quite surprising. Luck was on our side, because the road was raised up a little above the level of the land around it. And anyway, we got to the other side, and I'm not quite certain where John Howard's quarters were, but we dumped this ammunition, and I went down to see John Howard, who seemed to be over the moon, and he invited me to drink some bottled water which they'd found down there. Unknown to me at the time, they had in fact found champagne, or at least there were 100 bottles of champagne apparently kept in the cafe, hidden somewhere or other, which some of it was passed over to the boys. But John Howard offered me blasted mineral water, when in fact all the rest of them were drinking champagne, which I thought was a bit of a shame.
In what way did he seem to be over the moon?
he was totally over the moon in the fact that his operation had been successful. This was the thing, and the powers had reinforced him, and he was sitting in his command post, delighted. I suppose he'd had months and months of worry whether, in fact, the gliders would get to their objectives, whether, in fact, the troops would be successful in capturing both of their objectives or not. And he seemed to be in a state of euphoria at the time, that, in fact, the thing had been a success. And I think at this stage, by that stage, the brigade commander had come across the bridge, and maybe the divisional commander had also come across the bridge and moved up with him. And anyway, he was nattering to me about something or other. I can't quite remember what it was, but it was certainly something about how good his boys had been and so forth and so on. Anyway, I found myself back with my two lads on the other side of the on the other side, back to the bridge over the River Orne. And I don't suppose we'd been there for more than 20 minutes when the order came through that Todd Sweeney, take your platoon across to Pegasus Bridge. And it wasn't a question of walking along there, not in my outfit. You had to get across there as quickly as possible, which meant doubling all the way. We were lightly armed. We didn't have a, there was no great problem to us. And we were put down by this hedgerow on the other side of Pegasus Bridge with orders to counterattack on the village of Laport, I think it was. P-O-R-T, Laport. And it was then that I suppose, certainly in my regiment, it's a famous thing, but it was there that Todd Sweeney, my platoon commander, bumped into Richard Todd, the film actor, who was a paratroop. And it was just before we were going into the attack on Laport. And we were down behind the hedgerow, waiting to go, when in the distance, somebody could hear bagpipes playing. And the order of the day previously had been that we were going to be relieved by British troops pushing up from the invasion, which had started at 6 o'clock in the morning, to move through our positions and take up position right on the other side of the bridges. And we heard the bagpipes. And lo and behold, probably 5 minutes later, and we hadn't attacked Laport, chaps with green berries came streaming along the road. They happened to be Lord Lovett's commandos, and walking along with Lord Lovett was his piper, Bill Millin, blowing the bagpipes. And we just sat there and watched in amazement as these green berry commandos came along the road. I think as they moved over the bridge, sniper activity became very intense, and we could see that several of these commandos were in fact shot in the head, killed outright. And I've got an idea that it was then decided by Lovett's commandos to put on their tin hats. And I seem to remember that the last of them streaming away across the bridge, all of them had their tin hats on. They streamed away across Pegasus Bridge and they moved to the other side of the bridge over the River Orne and took up positions somewhere up there, I don't quite know where. But there seemed to be an endless stream of them. There must have been 600 or 700 of them moved through. And from then until from then until early afternoon, I think we went back to our own positions on the other side of the bridge. But there's one thing I do remember, of course, is being introduced by Wally Parr to his gun. Maybe Wally's told you about his gun.
Yes.
He was delighted to show me his gun, because we were good friends in any case. This big gun, sunk in the ground in a big gun pit. He'd never fired one of these things in his life before. But he and his number two, I think it was, Jack Bailey, decided to be number two on this gun. And I think also Billy Gray was there too. And for some, they must have been pretty clever, because they managed to load this gun with ordinary shells, armoured piercing shells, and managed to fire the thing, which is quite remarkable, really. And all sorts of little things took place that particular day, I remember. Things that you're apt to forget about. Like, in the evening, watching the rest of the 6th Airborne Division coming in to land. A mass of gliders appearing in the sky. No opposition to them, I don't think. I don't think there were any German planes in the vicinity. I think they were probably too well protected by the RAF. And this mass of gliders coming in and landing to the east of the River Orne. Remember that only too well. And at that time, one felt one could relax. And it's possible, no, even then we didn't eat. I remember that we had to leave our position on the River Orne to find our way into our next objective, which happened to be meeting up with the rest of the battalion of the Ochsenbucks and grouping, and then moving to the further objective, which happened to be a little village called Eskerville. And it was probably fairly dark when we eventually got on the road, started marching. No opposition at all. And we got into Romville probably at midnight. And it was there that we had something to eat. I remember that. Probably the company cooks had, in fact, arranged their kitchens by that stage, and I think we got something to eat there, probably by midnight. And at that stage, my platoon was intact, with the exception of one chap who'd been wounded. That's right. One chap who'd been carted back wounded. I'm not quite certain where he was probably fired on by this German patrol earlier on during the night. And I remember we had 2 hours sleep in Romville, and then we were woken up probably at about 3 o'clock in the morning to move to our final objective, Eskerville, which was about a mile and a half, I suppose, from Romville. And it's there that we really met our first serious opposition, in that Panzer Grenadiers of the 21st Panzer Division were in fact probing forward at that particular stage. And we moved very slowly from Romville to Eskerville. Which company was in front, I don't remember. D Company certainly wasn't at the front. And we could hear the sound of machinery, possibly tanks or armoured vehicles, as we moved up into Eskerville. On the way, my section spotted a German slit trench through an orchard, probably 600-700 yards away. May have been less, may have been 500 yards away. And we opened fire on this slit trench with a Bren gun. Bren guns were very good weapons, actually, very accurate. certainly up to 600 yards, you could rely on them, as long as you had a good gunner. And I think in those days, the brain guns, or our brain guns, had one tracer bullet in five, so you could spot the trajectory of the shots which you were in fact firing. There seemed to be no noise coming from this slip trench. We fired at it. There was no reply to it. And so we jumped up once again and got into the hedgerows and started on our move to Eskerville. Now, I think we started moving to Eskerville possibly at 5 o'clock in the morning, something like that, and we didn't reach our position in Eskerville until, this was a mile and a half away, until about 11 o'clock. What was going on in front, I'm never too certain. But we did eventually find out, and we did eventually hear with our own ears, some of our anti-tank guns being knocked out. They were being fired upon by tanks. Which tanks? I don't know. People say Tiger tanks. I doubt it. Maybe they were French tanks. Maybe they were smaller German tanks. But my position to take up in Eskerville, or my platoon's position to take up in Eskerville, was the left-hand flank front, which happened to be a farmhouse. And it happened to be a farmhouse which was surrounded by a wall, probably five foot high and about a foot thick. That wall surrounded the farmhouse probably for something like half of its length on that particular corner, and the other bit was taken up by hedgerows, but it was raised up a bit from the ground. D Company managed to get into their into this location without too much trouble. It meant dashing across roads and escaping machine gun fire and the rest of it, but we eventually got into this position, and it then did seem to become a little desperate, because first thing, we couldn't poke our heads over this wall, or we tried to, and bullets came across. Also in this little walled garden, or walled part of the farmhouse, there were several apple trees, and the thing that I was bothered about were mortar shells, in fact, landing in the apple trees and spraying their stuff out in all sorts of directions. And we tried to bang holes through this wall. We were successful. It took quite a time, managing to pick out the mortar and get a hole through this wall, as I say, about 12 inches thick. And as soon as a hole appeared, a bullet came through it. I found out afterwards, in fact, that there was a ring of German snipers just 30 yards the other side of this wall. And I also found out a little later on that I remember the name of the second in command was Captain Brian Pridey. That's right, Pridey. Referring to the chap on the River Dease, who in fact shot up this German patrol after telling the platoon commander to lay flat. Yeah, I remember that now. Where was I? Yes, on the other side of this wall, with German snipers in front, 200 to 300 yards away was German armour. I think it was light armour. I don't think it was a heavy armour. And beyond that, of course, were the German mortars of the 21st Panzer Division. It was probably a probing attack by the Germans. And the only way we could, in fact, contact them was there was a little gate by the side of this wall, a bit further up. And if you were clever enough to crawl through, you would in fact see the countryside on the other side with the German stuff coming along. And it was there that one of our platoon members, Lowell Stacey, got his MM, because he went through there with a Bren gun, did in fact manage to engage the enemy, but he was badly wounded. And a little later on, Todd Sweeney found he was missing, and much to his credit, went back and managed to extricate poor old Lowell Stacey, who was badly wounded. And this is where Todd Sweeney, in fact, got his MC from. Anyway, back on my sector, I, at that particular stage, I suppose... yes, very interesting. I said to my lads, I said, "You've had nothing to eat, boys. Eat your iron rations." Now, to eat iron rations, there's got to be an order from the colonel that you can eat your iron rations. But I said, "No, you eat your iron rations, you're hungry. And we're either going to be killed here, all of us, or we're going to be captured, or we're going to be wounded." I said, "There's no way that I can see that we're going to get out of this place, so eat your iron rations." And at that stage, I was a senior corporal in that particular little sector at the time. I had, oh dear, it's difficult to remember, but I might have had two of my section with me. And I had some of headquarters platoon with me. And there was probably, out of the dozen or so men I had there, there was probably seven or eight of them wounded, incapable of doing anything at all. You know, either from mortar shells or one thing or another. And eventually the order came to pull out. And so we collected up the wounded as best we could, and we pulled back. It was quite a large farmhouse, this one. And we pulled back to the centre of the farm, and... from what I remember now, each six or seven men as they came along were told to get back to a village called Heruvelette.
Called what?
Heruvelette. Heruvellet. We were told to go back there, that's right. We did not know, in fact, at the time it was Heruvelette. We were told the directions to go, and it actually finished up in this village of Heruvelette, or just outside the village. And anyway, I saw Captain Pridey there, and he said to me, he said, "What's it like there?" I said, "Well, it's a bit rough." And I told him, I said, there was German armour over there, and there were German snipers. And he said, "You know, could I get up there with a radio? The radio would be linked from him to me, and he would, in fact, get in touch with the gunners with his radio, who..."